Last time I made the argument, whether it was a very strong one or not, you'll have to decide, that actually verse 11 goes with 12 and 13 because of the fact that the issue of confronting one another, holding each other accountable, however you want to translate that parakaleo verb in verse 11, and the building up of one another with the idea that there are faults and flaws and weaknesses in each of us that are met by strengths in others of us, and that by the interaction of the whole, each individual is built up. That actually is ambiguous enough in terms of what he's dealing with that I think verse 12 gives the details for it. The issue of diligent labor, verse 12, middle of the verse, have charge over you, verse, end of the verse, give you instruction. I think those are the three elements that actually do the encouraging and the building up. So, for that reason, I consider verses 11, 12, and 13 pretty much a paragraph, even though there is a shift in verses 12 and 13 in terms of the body and the select group at the top, the ones that are over you, have charge over you in the Lord. That obviously refers to a group above or responsible for the church at large in the local place. But anyway, we talked last time about Paul entering into a parakalesis mode, and we've talked multiple times about how you translate that. In some places, there's not a one word. You can't just say encourage, because that might not work. I mean, if somebody's down the dumps, translating parakaleo, encourage, is probably a good translation. But when you do it in a general sense, you might have this person in the dump and this person walking in arrogance and this person wandering away because of whatever. And he says parakalesis. In other words, just do whatever you have to do to get people back in to walking beside the Lord. That's calling them alongside. That's the basic idea. And the building up of the brethren is, it's a fundamental assumption in the New Testament that the body will help each other, the members of the body will help each other in the function of the body. And as I started out, I made the claim last time that it's actually verse 12 that gives us a methodology for doing that. And this evening what we're going to do is to look into these next two verses, because they have primarily to do with, fundamentally, they have to do with being willing to be built up. Until, and you have the ability then to turn around and build somebody else up. Because verse 12 is asking the church body as a whole to develop a certain attitude toward a select group of people in the body that are over the body in terms of responsibility and doing the labor and the instructing. That assumes a certain level of maturity, and biblically that would be your teaching elders, which all of them are supposed to be. Elders are supposed to be apt to teach. So the elder function, the body survives best when the elders are functioning biblically, but in order for elders to be effective, the people have to be willing to adopt a certain attitude toward them, and that's what verse 12 is actually saying. But in the saying of it, he also tells us how we're going to be encouraged, called alongside, and built up, the terms that are in here. So, Paul is actually giving us in verse 12 a methodology for building up the brethren. And there's some implications there that I want us to think about, because it seems to me that verse 12, when he says, "We request of you, brethren, that you appreciate those who diligently labor among you and have charge over you in the Lord and give you instruction, and that you esteem them very highly in love because of their work." And then this statement, "Live in peace with one another," just comes out of... And there's some implications that come with statements like that. And one of the implications of having the right kind of attitude toward those who are diligently laboring and have charge over you and giving you instruction, one of the fundamental assumptions of that exhortation is, an implication from Paul's teaching in this letter, because over and over throughout the first two chapters of 1 Thessalonians, Paul returned to the reality of the impact of his and Silvanus' and Timothy's behavior on the Thessalonians. He said over and over, "You know what manner of men we were among you. You know that we set the pattern and you guys became followers of us, and then you became the standard for other people to follow. But it all has to do with what kind of people are we." And that implies something. Since the letter itself is all about establishing, firmly establishing the hope, so that the issues of the two, 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, the issue is the biblical hope. We've called this, ever since the beginning, Paul's message of motivating hope. If our expectation of from God is firmly locked in, then the building process will go on. And one of the issues of Paul's emphasis on the kind of men, we request you that you appreciate, is a translational word that means to know them. That you know those who are doing this stuff. Well, why? And I think the implication is that hope is caught and not taught. In other words, the words have to be there. You do have to teach the right ideas. But you can teach all the right ideas and people still live hopelessly, because they don't believe them. And part of the reason they don't believe them is because they don't see anybody believing them. And when you don't see it being applied, especially by the person who's doing the teaching, then it's easy to blow it off. I've used this illustration before, but I know of a pastor who's, he's obviously self-indulgent, way overweight, and he was preaching to thousands of people that come every Sunday to hear him stand up there and do his thing. And he was talking about gluttony and that, and he just laughed his way through the whole thing with himself as an illustration. And I know that everybody went home laughing about that, and I'm almost positive that no one went home deciding that, you know, the discipline of the Spirit includes my eating habits. And therefore, I really want to start depending on God to oversee my eating habits. I almost guarantee you nobody went home and said that. And the reason is because the guy that was preaching doesn't do it. It's obvious he doesn't do it, and he jokes about not doing it. So when you make light of something, then people will dismiss it automatically, especially they will dismiss it if they didn't really want to hear it in the first place. I mean, if you don't want to have to deal with something and somebody makes light of it and he's your teacher, then ignore him. So I really believe that Paul thought carefully in 1 Thessalonians, the first two chapters. He kept saying, I hope these people stick with this. I don't know what to think about them and I can't get back to them, so I'm going to send Timothy back there. And I hope. And then in chapter 3, when Timothy and Silvanus came to Corinth and said, everything that you wanted them to do, they're doing. They're hanging in there. The persecution hasn't dissuaded them. They haven't turned away. They haven't become like the Galatians. They are remarkable in their solid commitment to walking with God through whatever comes. And that made Paul's day. But because he was in this mode of encouragement to hang in there, he kept saying, you know, we set this pattern for you. You know that we were your example and you followed our example, and you know what manner of men we were, and you know. The whole point being, do it like we do it. It's kind of like the old, it's now becoming a cliche because I've heard it a lot of times, but, you know, be a witness for Jesus and use words if you have to. And I'm not dismissing the reality of the necessity of clarifying with words, but the fact is, the hope, particularly the hope, is caught and not taught. And that bothers me when I hear over and over and over and over and over and over and over people say things like, well, you know, I want the Lord to come, but And the reason is that they're saying that is because that's what their teachers are saying too. Paul said, I want to die. I want to go and be with Jesus. It's more necessary for me to be here with you, but if I had my choice, I'd be out of here today. You just can never hear anybody saying that. But it's irrational not to say that. The glory that's to be revealed is going to be so much greater than anything down here. Hey, we ought to all be ready to pull a trigger, except we can't. We just have to wait until it's time. But we ought to want to be time to go to be with the Lord. But the reason we don't is because we're not hearing that and we're not seeing it. We're seeing people hanging on to this life with everything they've got. All the while claiming, I'm a believer in Jesus. Mm-hmm. So, I really do believe that hope is caught. It's not really... You can teach the words, but the teaching has got to be done by an example. And that implication leads to another implication, and that is that the lack of a legitimate example is the primary cause of disbelief by the church as a whole. That's the reason for verse 12. There are supposed to be some guys among you who are setting the standard and setting the example, and you... The church as a whole has a responsibility to think about those people properly. Now, I made the distinction last time that we're not a church here. We're a Bible study, and I'm the dad, and you are the kids, and the in-laws, and outlaws, and all that. So, technically, the text doesn't actually have a direct application to us, but the general implications are there anyway. I mean, if I'm not setting an example, you're going to blow off whatever you hear from me that you don't want to hear, because Dad's not doing it either, so what's the deal? I understand the burden of that. But I also understand that in verse 12, he's calling on the church to adopt an attitude toward their elders. And so we're going to look at that, understanding that we're not a church, but there are some overlapping things that are going on. So, given that, it shouldn't be any surprise that Paul's wherefore in verse 11, after laying out the specifics regarding the hope, runs pretty rapidly to Paul's requests. And he makes a couple of requests in verse 12. They're identified the that's of verse 12 and 13. That you, quote, appreciate, and verse 13, that you esteem. And we'll talk about both of those terms, but what he's asking them to do. So let's just start with that idea that's in verse 12. We request of you. That word request is translated in King James, beseech you. It gives you the impression with the word beseech that you're begging. And in some of the contexts of the New Testament, that's exactly what that word means. A woman comes to Jesus and her daughter's demon-possessed and she asks him. The word is translated, asks him to cast the demon out of her daughter. She didn't just ask that. She was begging for it. You know, there was this built-in pleading because her daughter's situation is terrible. And Jesus started out by telling her, no, you Gentile, you don't have any business with the children's food. And she thought about 30 seconds about what she was going to say to that. And she said, yeah, but even the dog's going to eat under the table. So if the kids drop the food, the dogs get it. I know I'm a dog, but I also know that your children are dropping stuff on the floor. And I get that if they do it. And he said, for that reason, I'll cast the demon out of your daughter. So it was her humility, her willingness to take her place in the mindset of the day and take it in the humility. But the whole idea there is that the word request, beseech, beg, ask, that word is all over the place in terms of what it means. For example, if I want to ask you a question, I would use this word to say, I ask you this, and all I want is an answer to the question. But on the other hand, it can be used in the context like the Syrophoenician woman or the, you know, the guy whose son is demon-possessed, and he's a Jew, and he comes to Jesus and cast him out, please. That's the idea here. And we don't really know how strong this request is on Paul's part, except that it's a potent part of the whole attitude thing. And so he's saying, I'm asking you to do this. Two things. That you, quote, appreciate, quote, those who diligently labor among you, have charge over you, and give you instruction. And that, second request, you esteem them very highly in love because of their work. So those are the two requests, and I want us to think about the first one first. Paul's first request, that the Thessalonians, the New American Standard translates appreciate those, but I think that's misleading, because he's not talking about appreciating them. The word is not typically a word for appreciating. It's a word used in 1 Thessalonians for getting to know somebody. And it's the very word that Paul uses in the first part of the letter when he says, you know what manner of men we were. He didn't say you appreciate what manner of men we were. He said, we came from Philippi and told you what happened to us in Philippi. You know that we got ourselves thrown into prison and beaten for boldly proclaiming the gospel when we were at Philippi, and we came to you and did the same thing, which means that the treatment we got there didn't dissuade us from being aggressive in the proclamation. And he says, you know that about us, and we're asking you to adopt that same kind of an attitude, be willing to pay the price to be faithful in your calling. And he's saying that not on the basis of their appreciation of him, or even their appreciation of the example he set. He's talking about knowing it, that this is something you saw in us. This is something that came across as a real big deal, because in that day, I mean, they sent people from Philippi to Thessalonica to stir the pot because they hated what Paul was doing. And everywhere he went, that's the kind of stuff he ran into, pretty much. There were not very many pleasant experiences in the preaching of the gospel as Paul went from town to town. Most of them he ran into a buzzsaw. So, he is saying, get to know these people. And I really think that what he's saying is, you need to know these people that are laboring among you, have charge over you, and giving you instruction. And the reason you need to know them is because you're going to respond to their, particularly the nouthetic confrontation, the instruction at the end of verse 12. You're going to run into them telling you things you don't want to hear. And you need to know them well enough to know whether they're doing that themselves or not. Because if they're not doing it themselves, them exhorting you to do it is just so much hot air. And I ran into that immediately after we left North Carolina. The church there struggled for a little while, and then they decided to call a guy as their next teaching elder, pastor, whatever you want to call him. And he came on the scene with an agenda and said, I want to do a series on evangelism. And so he did. And so when Trey called me and said, this is what he's doing, I said, let me ask you this. Is he winning anybody to Christ? Is he doing this personal evangelism? Is he seeing people come to know the Lord and that? Well, no. I said, well then, he has no business telling you to do stuff he's not doing. I mean, I'm all for evangelism, except I'm not all for evangelism. I don't know when the last time I shared the gospel with somebody was. But part of the reason is I don't go out of my way to go find somebody to express the gospel to. I mean, I have a certain circle of people I meet with, and almost all of them professing believers. So, but that wasn't the case back then. And I think it's enormously bad policy to preach something that you don't do. So, especially making it a series of a topical series. That's the issue of knowing. We want you to know these guys. The reason we want you to know them is because you knew us and you followed our example. We set a pattern for you and you followed it. Okay, what does he want them to know? Who does he want them to know? Well, he qualifies three things about them. they diligently labor among you. That diligent labor issue is the word that's used in the first part of chapter 1, verse 3, where he talks about the work of the faith, the labor of the love, and the steadfastness of the hope. The word labor is the word labor. What he's talking about is he set the standard early by talking about the labor of the love. And back then when we were studying that, we noticed that the difference between labor and work is simply intensity. You work the work of the faith, but you labor when it's a matter of your love. And all that is intensity. I mean, you'll do stuff because you believe certain things. But when love's involved, you'll go over the top in terms of what you have to do because of the value of the person that you love. Every parent knows this. You will go over the top for your kids. You might not do it for anybody else's kids. And the reason's because they're your kids. You love them more than you love your neighbors or whatever. Well, the labor of the love is the intensity issue of the work. So he's talking about the issues of the work in this text. They diligently labor among you to do what? Back up to verse 11. To exercise this parakalesis ministry to the church, calling people to walk with God, calling on them to do whatever they have to do to walk in the light with the Lord, and to build each other up so that they address the weaknesses with strength and they admit their own weaknesses and are met by others with strength so that the church as a whole is being built up. That's the labor. And if it's love-driven, it's legitimate. If it's not love-driven, it's not. There's an awful lot of stuff that would never be done if we insisted on it being done properly. And a lot of people say, well, you really want this to be done. No, I do not want it to be done if it's not done driven by love. You just don't do it. If you can't do it out of love, just don't do it. For two reasons. Number one, you're not going to get any credit for it anyway. If it's not love-driven, Paul said in 1 Corinthians 13, it'll profit you nothing. And what he didn't say is it'll profit most everybody else for nothing too. Because labor that is expended without love as the driving motivation, I mean legitimate love as the driving motivation, actually turns people off. They get to feeling used and abused and all that. And so all that effort is just a waste. And so when he talks about their labor among you, he's talking about what's supposed to be going on, and that is they're diligently involved in trying to build up the church. They're diligently involved because they love two things, they're persons. They love the Lord, and they love the Lord's people. And therefore, they want to serve Him. They love Him enough to put out the effort, and they love them enough to put out the effort to try to build them up. And I, since I'm a teacher by gift, I really think that the big part of that building up stuff is understanding, learning and understanding the truth so that you can communicate and help other people see it. And therefore, I would argue that if you're not teaching people, you don't love them. But I already said, most of this stuff is caught, not taught. So even if you're not teaching them with your mouth, you need to be teaching them by your example. If you're not teaching them by example or by mouth, you don't love them. That's just the bottom line. You don't spank your kids, you don't love them. That's Solomon's wisdom. That's the whole idea here. So the first thing he says is that you're supposed to be getting to know these people who are diligently laboring among you. And the reason you need to get to know them is because you need to find out if that labor is legitimate. Why are they doing this stuff? And that's the most depressing issue, I think, in cultural Christianity in America. Because when you find out what the heads of the bodies really want to do, you lose your respect for them. Not always, but more times than not. It's far better to never get to know the guy. Just listen to what he has to say, and then, you know, if you're motivated, fine. But Paul would say, no, 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 no. You need to get to know these people. And he's assuming they're on target. But what if they're not? Well, you still need to get to know them. Because if they're not on target, you need to beware. They will teach you heresy. Sooner or later, a lack of love for God and a lack of love for his people will produce heresy. And you need to know. So, he says, I urge you, I request of you, I beg of you, whatever, however you want to translate that with however level of intensity, I want this to happen. You get to know those people. And the first thing you get to know about them is their motivation for their labor. Because it will show, sooner or later, it's going to come out what they really want. And that's the issue of the question of why they who do the labor are doing the labor. Why? I don't know if I told you all this or not. It's another one of those little things. But 2 or 3 weeks ago or a month ago, I was asked to serve on an ordination council. Did I tell you that? For a guy. Church in Opelousas had called a fellow to be their pastor, but he'd never been ordained, and he wanted to be ordained before he produced or did a wedding for a couple in the church. What, I don't remember all that stuff. But anyway, this calling out for guys to serve on the ordination council. Well, I didn't respond to the call to start with. So then I got a phone call. Daryl, would you be willing to serve on this ordination council? I said, when is it? And he gave me a date, and I said, I can't. I'm already tied up. And I was glad I already had a thing because I didn't want to be too brutal, but it caught me off guard. Frankly, I thought I was supposed to initiate the response if I wanted to serve, but nonetheless, caught me by surprise. But afterwards, I'll never be caught by surprise again. If somebody calls me and asks me, will you serve on the ordination council? I'm going to say, no, I won't. And I'll tell you why. I don't ordain anybody to the ministry I don't know. I don't care who it is. If I don't know them, I'm not going to lay my hands on them. They ain't happening. And the reason is because I honestly believe there are too many men in the ministry already. They're not in it because they love the Lord and his people. They have a vision of ministry that suits their goals and agenda, and they're after that, and that's what they're going for. And I've got no use for that whatsoever. But in Acts 20, verse 30, there is a realization on Paul's part that he actually declared in Galatians 6:13. In the Acts 20 setting, Paul is on his way to Jerusalem. He's going back through Ephesus, Asia Minor, and he knows that he's never going to see these people again in the flesh. So he's just doing his little drive-by, bye-bye, and going on down to Jerusalem. And he wants to tell them goodbye, basically. And everywhere he goes, he runs into these people who are saying, don't go to Jerusalem. The Spirit says if you go to Jerusalem, they're going to bind you and, you know, hogtie you and do all kinds of mean things to you. And he says, I'm going to go to Jerusalem. And I came by here not to have you tell me I'm not going, but to tell you a few things. And one of the things he told them, he got the elders of the church in Ephesus together. And in Acts 20, he said to them in verse 30, I know that after I leave here, some from among you will arise and teach heresies in order to, according to verse 30, draw off disciples for themselves. Well, Galatians 6:13 said that the legalists were doing, they're teaching their doctrine in order to glory in your flesh. In other words, make disciples for themselves. Make a big name for themselves because they're so potent in this disciple making that everybody recognizes what a good disciple maker you are, all that kind of stuff. That's why Paul says you need to get to know those who labor among you because you need to know why they're doing what they're doing. Because heresy will never show up first in words. It'll first show up in motivations, and then as you begin to listen a little more carefully, you'll discover that they're trying to make you do something that God doesn't want you really doing. That's the way it works. And I think the letter to the Laodiceans in Revelation chapter 3 is the final stage of that process. The Laodiceans are lukewarm. They don't care. They've got all this and Jesus too. And they'd rather have all this. They're not hot or cold. I think that's the end result of the church not getting to know those who labor among them. They don't know what's going on there. So, the issues of motivation have existed from the beginning. You can see that in Galatians. It's a significant problem, and those who are subject to the efforts of others to build them up need to know where they're coming from. They need to know these people that are putting forth these efforts so that they can know where those folks are coming from and where that's going to take them, especially if they follow them. So that's Paul's first request. We urge you to know those who diligently labor among you. Second characteristic is, and have charge over you in the Lord. Well, that phrase means that these people have been exalted to their position over the others in the body, and it's supposed to be having been done by the Lord. Those who have been put there by the Lord. The verb that's translated here, have charge over you, is used about 8 times in the New Testament, or 8 contexts. 4 of them are in 1 Timothy, and they have to do with elders and their attitudes and skills, as shown by the way they handle their own households, and especially their children. So, having charge means to act like a father does to his immature children. And in a very real sense, that's really the elders' reality. The elders are elders because they are no more children. They have grown up in the Lord, and now they're qualified by their own experience and faith and longevity and walking with God to be trusted by God to help others who are just starting out the process to do the same thing. Well, what if you haven't done that thing? You can't help somebody do something you haven't done. And the sad thing about a lot of church leaders is they have never discipled anybody because they themselves have never consistently walked with God enough to know what's valuable and what's true. So they can't do it. But that's their position. Paul is assuming that that's not the case of these guys. And I make that statement based on historical reality. How long was Paul in Thessalonica? A few weeks. Where did these guys come from that God put over the church there? Well, they obviously had to have been some people in Thessalonica who had a Jewish background, theologically immersed reality in things of God, so that what they really needed to get everything to click in place was a clear understanding of the gospel and a personal relationship with God. It's kind of like Saul of Tarsus, immersed in scripture, schooled in the understanding of all kinds of stuff, but it was twisted out of joint because he didn't believe that Jesus was the historical Christ. And so when Jesus confronted him, it didn't take Paul a long time to become competent to help others. He had this background in God that God had been working that Saul didn't even realize. And when God did that final little click, 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 and everything adjusted and everything came into focus, and he could go back from Arabia to Damascus and go into the synagogue and confound all of them by preaching Jesus and answering every objection. Well, where'd he get that? I think he got that the same place these guys who have been put over the church in Thessalonica by the Lord got it. It is a historical background with God in some senses where God was working to do some things. But in order for it to click into place, they had to come to grips with the truth about Messiah, who he is, what he did. And when that all clicked into place, it didn't take them long to bubble to the top. We understand what's going on here, and now we can help you do this stuff. So that's what he means. They have been put over you by the Lord himself, and you need to get to know those people that the Lord has done this with. Because you have to keep in mind that the issues of the Lord making decisions about people was compromised in some sense by his statement, Jesus' statement in John's Gospel, "Have not I chosen all of you, but one of you is a devil." And he was talking there about Judas Iscariot, and who was he in the group? The guy that they gave all the money to. He was the treasurer. He was the one they trusted with the finances of the group. Got to keep in mind that you need to get to know these people who have been put over you, I would say, by the Lord, with a caveat built in. You get to know them to see if the Lord really did put them in that place. I'm asking you to do this. Get to know them. They have charge over you in the Lord, as far as you know, until you get to know them. Because everything's crucial here. The whole idea is that the body needs some help growing up, and the Lord puts people into place to do that. And God charges the men that he's put into place to do that with a charge. And they're supposed to set the example, and they're supposed to insist that everybody follow their example. That's the ministry of building people up. And then in the issue that's third in the list, they give you instruction. That word "give you instruction" is a kind of an interesting term. It's only used 8 times, like that other one. 8 times in the New Testament. 7 of those 8 are found in Paul's letters. Twice Paul uses it in 1st and 2nd Thessalonians. In other words, once in each of those letters. It's interesting. He uses this word. It's nuthetēo. There was a guy when I was in seminary who had developed this thing called nousetic counseling. And he used the nuthetēo verb to give a definition to the kind of counseling he was talking about. Now, whether he got it right or not is beside the point. The point is, 1 Thessalonians 5:14, 2 Thessalonians 3:15 use this word when it means you need to confront some people that are out of line. In other words, nuthetēo is not so much instruction as it is confrontation of the unruly. Admonish the unruly. If they insist on their waywardness, admonish them as a brother, not as an enemy. Those are the contexts of 1 Thessalonians 5 and 2 Thessalonians 3. In other words, this word is used when people are out of line and are not really inclined to get in line. And it's the elder's job to say, you're going to get in line. And these are the reasons why you're going to get in line. And give them a biblical basis for walking with God and insisting on it. And if they don't get in line then, there are some steps that need to be taken. They're outlined in the scriptures, and these guys are supposed to apply them. But the point is, that's going to be the most difficult aspect of ministering to people. It's the least enjoyable element of building people up in the faith. Some people don't want to be built up in the faith. They do not want to be corrected. They don't want to have to shift their priorities and behavior and all that. They just don't want that. Well, if they're going to call themselves Christians, at some point they're going to have to be held accountable to the claim. So, what happens typically with the giving instruction thing, the confrontation of the unruly, the admonishing of the willful in rebellion, one of the things that invariably will lead to is conflict in the body. Invariably, you shouldn't have treated that guy that way. He's a friend of mine, or whatever. It's going to create discord in the body. But you can't let discord in the body trump insisting that behavior fall in line with the doctrine. And generally, the conflict comes, and then there's this lingering tension thing that follows. This is the task of verse 12 or 11. The parakalesis and the building one another up. There are three parts to it. One of them is diligent labor. One of them is having authority from the Lord. And the other is confronting stuff that needs to be confronted. Paul says, I want you to get to know the people who are doing that. And then in verse 13, I want you to make an attitude adjustment about that. I want you to esteem them very highly in love. This is fundamental because esteeming somebody highly simply means you're going to follow their lead. And nobody is going to follow the lead of somebody they suspect in terms of motive or doctrine or method. They're not going to do it. If they suspect them of not being properly loving, if they suspect them of not being established by the Lord for this position, if they suspect them for ulterior motives in their confrontation of them, they're not going to follow them. So when Paul says in verse 13, I'm asking you to do this, he's saying, look, this is a two-way street. If you want to be built up in the Lord, you're going to have to develop an attitude toward the people who can help you, and that attitude has to be respect or estimation of them as high in walking in the truth. And it requires a certain graciousness of heart. No elder's perfect. You can find flaws in people if you look hard enough. But the truth of the matter is you ought to have to look hard. If you can just see them, then there's something too immature about that individual to be in this position. But because you can always find a fault if you look hard enough, then you have to kind of develop a gracious attitude and say, okay, I see that he's not perfect, but he's got a pattern of legitimacy, and I'm going to let God use him to help me grow up. That's the attitude that he's asking them to develop. The bottom line is, according to verse 13, the work is worth, it deserves a good attitude on the part of those who are subjected to it. If somebody tells me I'm out of line, and I know them well enough to think that they might even be saying this for my good, their work for God deserves enough respect on my part to at least give them a hearing. That's required. That's the bottom line. The work deserves a good attitude. And then he makes one final statement, and I think it's just automatic. If you're going to talk about, especially the admonishment thing and the conflict issue, then it makes sense for Paul to wind this up by saying this: live in peace with one another. In other words, make peace with one another one of your goals. Don't let it be an excuse for not doing stuff because of the conflict that may come. But don't let conflict just come. Make an effort to be peaceful. Give the guys the benefit of the doubt. Work with them as much as you can because you've gotten to know them. Let them have their impact on you as much as you can. And don't create problems. Don't stir up conflict. Because there is very little edification that goes on when conflict is ruling the day. When everybody's hot under the collar and at odds with each other because of what's going on, there is very little, if any, edification that happens. There's too much emotional buzz going on, killing the impact of the edification. Dealing with problematical people tends to stir up discord. But those who would tend to create discord are, in this verse, commanded to make every effort not to. And that's what verse 12 and 13 seem to be driving at. Paul's serious about us wanting his disciples to walk with the Lord. That's what this is about, walking with the Lord and having some helpers that are willing to help us do that, and then giving them the ability to do it by getting to know them and holding them up highly in our own estimation because of the work they're trying to do.